Before we begin today, let me ask if anyone has any questions. The question is, at the time of Jesus' trials, the high priest asked Jesus, tell us whether you are the Son of God or not. And Jesus first says, it is as you say, which I'll talk about in a second. And then he says, and you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of God. And the high priest became very angry. Now you have to take, he split his robe. You have to take that whole response, not just the part. The part in the question was, Jesus said, you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of God, and the priest became very angry. Actually, that is only the last part of Jesus' response, and you have to take the whole response. Because you see, in the Jewish world of Jesus' day, there was a certain kind of court protocol when you appeared before the Jewish court. And when the the high priest, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, when he asked Jesus this question, there was something that happened before that. He says, I adjure you by the living God, tell us whether you be the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One or not, or something like that. Okay, when he says, I adjure you by the living God, that was a specific legal expression in the Jewish world, which essentially was, I am putting you under an oath to tell us the truth. Whatever it is, you tell us the truth. Then his question, are you the Son of God? The affirmative answer, in other words, the yes answer, was not yes. The affirmative answer was, it is as you say. And in the Gospel of Matthew, this interchange is recorded exactly. And it is the exact Hebrew. It's translated, of course. But it is the exact Hebrew structures to this particular situation. In the Gospel of Mark and Luke, and I forget about John, but in the Gospel of Mark and Luke, I believe you get the high priest saying, are you the Son of God or the Son of the Blessed One or something? And Jesus is saying yes. Well, that was what he was saying. But in Matthew, you get the exact Hebrew form of the exchange. Whereas in Mark and Luke, you get the what might be called translated form for a non-Hebrew audience. And the full response translated for a non-Hebrew audience is, yes, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God. Well, Jesus, of course, took the term Son of Man to refer to himself more than anything else. And so he was, of course, in that context saying, yes, and you will see me seated at the right hand of God. So the entire response was what caused the high priest to tear his robe. Again, like the I am statement that we talked about before. And it's this entire exchange. The high priest was not able or willing to even entertain the possibility that this man standing in front of him could be God. And so it was very clear. Sometimes in modern liberal Bible interpretation, questions have been raised about whether Jesus ever actually claimed to be God or not. But if you read the Gospels and you read the accounts, you don't even have to read what Jesus says. Just read what happens sometimes. And you will see that, yes, he did claim to be God. And this was one of those times. He basically, in that court proceeding, said, I'm God. You're going to one day see me up there. And maybe you won't be so happy then. And you won't be so powerful then. He didn't say that, of course. But the high priest then took his robe and tore it. That was a sign of extreme anger and grief and mourning. And if I remember right, he says to the Sanhedrin then, why do we need any witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy of this man. And it was very clear in the context of Jesus' day that Jesus said he was God. And he said it directly to the high priest. And so this is why that there was so much anger. It was not just that he said, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God, or the Most High. But it was the entire response that said, he is God. Now, as far as using the term Most High, we, of course, don't have any Hebrew. By the way, there was a claim that about 100 years ago, there was still a Hebrew version of the Gospel of Matthew that had been preserved in a very ancient congregation in India, which tradition says is where Matthew went and was eventually martyred. But if, in fact, that claim was so, it has apparently been lost. It would be wonderful if ever that Gospel of Matthew at that church could be recovered, because most scholars believe Matthew was probably originally written in Matthew and only later translated into Greek. And while I'm sure that the translation is faithful to the original, there are little things like this that it would be really useful to know what Matthew said was said during the trial, because Jesus could easily have said that you will see the right hand, the Son of Man seated at the right hand of El Elyon. We just don't know. It certainly would fit. But again, we just don't know. Since we only have Greek versions, we can suppose, but we don't know for sure what the term was that was used. And maybe it was a different term altogether that was popular by Jesus' day. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yesterday we spent a long time looking at different aspects of God that are revealed in the Old Testament to us. And what we want to do today is we want to pick up with a couple of additional things in this area and then move on to the human-divine relationship. Now, I want to emphasize again, we are not doing a total thorough job of dealing with everything here because we simply do not have enough time. So I'm picking pieces out and I'm trying to give you Old Testament theology, but the main things. So think of this as an introduction to Old Testament theology. And you could certainly spend a lot more time on many of these things than we have a chance to do here. But this gives you a sense of what Old Testament theology is like, and it gives you a sense of the main ideas that would come in looking theologically at the Old Testament, and how Old Testament theology is different. It relies on New Testament, or rather Old Testament background and history, but it is different than simply Old Testament history, because it looks at the Old Testament from an entirely different approach and an entirely different manner. Okay, so one of the things that we need to look at, although you may not think so, is the whole concept of monotheism. We in our Western culture are very, very accustomed to talking about God in a monotheistic way, as though this is and always was the way in which people looked at the world. The thing is that monotheism, as we talk about it, is just one concept about the supernatural world. And it is not even a concept that is agreed upon universally around the world. So, for instance, I spend a lot of time now in China. In China, there are a lot of people who believe in Buddha. And Buddhism has many, many, many kind of lesser gods that are part of that tradition. Hinduism has, 30 million gods and goddesses that are worshipped by like 500 million believers. And so the idea of monotheism is not even today universal around the world. And I asked a Chinese colleague one time who lives in the United States, is now a United States citizen. Sometimes you would say something, or she would tell about something, and she would say, "Oh my God." And I've heard Chinese people do the same thing. And I asked her one time, what do Chinese think when they think or say, "Oh my God"? And she said, you know, most Chinese people believe in Buddhism, if they have a religion. But she said, all Chinese, probably, even the non-religious and the ones that are Buddhist as well, they believe that there is really something out there. They just don't know exactly what it is or who it is. Something beyond Buddha, something beyond the traditional Chinese religions and things like that. And so that's what they mean when they say, "Oh my God," is they're thinking about that, whatever it is out and beyond there. But this is a very polytheistic statement, because you see, they believe in multiple gods, and then there's something even higher, something even more out there beyond that. This conversation, by the way, took place only about 5 or 6 years ago, not 500 or 600 years ago or 5 or 6 centuries ago. This is a basic kind of an idea in the Chinese world today. And of course, if you go to India, you see lots of temples to various gods and goddesses. And their understandings of piety and religious devotion and these sorts of things are quite different from ours. But we have the idea that there is one God and only one God. Let me digress for a minute and say that actually creates a difficulty for Christians and Jews trying to understand Islam, and Islam trying to make itself fit with Christians and Jews. Because Christians and Jews have the idea there is one and only one God, which the Old Testament calls Elohim or Yahweh. The God of the Muslim world is Allah. And that is an Arabic form of El. And the assertion made by Muslims is that the God they honor and worship is exactly the same as the God of the Christians and Jews. And they are monotheistic just like we're monotheistic. And if a person does not understand the difference between Allah and the God of the Christians and Jews, then it's very easy to simply shake your head and say, yes, yes, there is only one God, whatever you call that God, whether it's Yahweh or Elohim or God or Allah or Bog or whatever word you use, there's really only one God. So yes, the Muslims must worship the same God that we worship. You have to get beyond the words. And if you get beyond the words, you will see that the Allah of the Muslims is a very different God in character from Elohim or Yahweh or Bog or whatever word we happen to use in our language to refer to God when we are a Christian or a Jew. And I'm not going to go through a whole process of that at the moment. We can do it at a break or something. But the characteristics, the teachings, the requirements, the assertions of Allah are dramatically actually opposed to those which we have received and which have been revealed to us as Christians and Jews. And there is really only one response to that, and that is that the Allah of the Muslims is not the same God as the God we worship. Now, a second question is Allah of the Muslims even a God? Or is Allah of the Muslims created lesser being, whereas we know and believe that our God is the one and only supreme God of the universe? And that's a whole different question. But even when you look at Islam versus Christianity and Judaism, you still get into this thing of one God or multiple gods. And it's very, very significant, actually, to not only understand some terminology, but to understand that This was the world of the Old Testament. And the idea of monotheism, as we think of monotheism, is something that is not universal today and has never been completely universal anywhere, even within Christianity, Judaism, and the rest of the world throughout history. And so it's kind of important to understand that when, for instance, you as a believer in Jesus want to talk to someone else and perhaps invite them to faith in Jesus Christ, it's really important to understand that they may not even share the same concept of God that you do. And monotheism is essentially a concept that we in the Jewish and Christian world have, and Islam, but of a different God, as the only God that there is. But even between the religions of Islam and Judaism and Christianity, you have these differences which indicate that it's two different gods that the people have in mind. So there are different concepts. Monotheism is, of course, the idea that there is one and only one God. That's it. And monotheism says that no matter what people think or do, there is one and only one God who is the creator, who is the redeemer, who is all of these things that we talked about previously. And this is the position of Judaism today. This is the position of Christianity today. But in the Old Testament, it was not always that way. The majority of the world in Old Testament times was polytheistic, or followed the practice of polytheism, which means many gods and goddesses. And as I said, one of the largest population groups in the world, and one of the five major religions of the world, Hinduism, is a polytheistic religion. They have three great gods, and they have millions of lesser gods. And I, again, don't want to go into all the details of Hinduism beyond that, but Hinduism is a very polytheistic religion. In Old Testament times, everybody around Israel was polytheistic. In Egypt, you had a very complex religious structure because you had two very different kinds of gods, actually. You had Amun-Ra, who was the great national god of the Egyptians, and more generally, you had Ra, which was the sun god. And these were, and all of the gods associated with Ra and Amun-Ra, were generally associated in some kind of a family manner. And you go beyond that, and you had an entirely different category of gods, with Osiris, Horus, Isis, and so on like that, which represented kind of the more spiritual dimension of birth and death and rebirth or resurrection or something like that. And each pharaoh was regarded as an incarnation, not just a representative of, but as an actual incarnation of the god Horus. Way before Moses' time, or even before Abraham's time, the ancient Egyptians had the idea of a god incarnate in human form. And that god was Horus, incarnate in the pharaoh. And according to the legend of Osiris, Isis, Horus, and so on, when the pharaoh died, the pharaoh remained a god incarnate, but incarnate as Osiris, the father of Horus. And the new pharaoh now became the incarnation of Horus. And so the idea of a god being incarnate in human form does not originate with the New Testament. And you don't even read anything about this in the Old Testament. But the concept existed 2,000 and 3,000 years before the New Testament. And in Egypt, that's the Egypt that the Israelites spent 400 years in. That's the Egypt that you see Abraham going to. The Egypt Moses was raised in and the Israelites fled from, and so forth. These were ideas very common in the Egyptian world that lay essentially to the west of Israel. The nations all around Israel had a very polytheistic system to them. And so they had gods for the planting and harvesting of food. They had gods for war, gods for the weather. They had gods for healing needs, and on it went. And one of the things that was actually spoken just a little tiny bit in the Old Testament concerning mostly the gods of the Canaanites, one of the principal gods of the Canaanites was the storm god, who was therefore responsible for giving the rain in its proper time for the planting and the harvesting, withholding the rain so that they could harvest, but giving the rain so that the seeds that were planted would grow. And to just be sort of a casual description of it, what would happen is that farmers might go out either before or after planting, and they would go to the temples of this particular god, and they would have sex with temple prostitutes to try to ensure that there would be abundant rain and a successful crop, and therefore a large harvest that they would be able to have. And in their world, this was the normal way in which people would, through religion, try to ensure that they would have a good agricultural season. Now, to us, we say, temple prostitutes, that's crazy. No, in their day, that was for the Canaanites, that was a very significant and important part of their world to try to ensure that, in fact, they had good agricultural seasons. Well, these are the kinds of different ways of thinking that you find in polytheistic worlds. Well, then there's another word that you may not have heard so much about called henotheism. Henotheism probably describes most of the idea in the Old Testament. Henotheism is the idea that there are other gods, but your God, first of all, is the only God you worship, and that your God is greater than any other God. Moses, for instance, probably was henotheistic, which means that there, for Moses, there was only one God, the God who appeared to him in the burning bush, the God who worked miracles through his staff, which we call, of course, the plagues on Egypt, the God who split the Red Sea so that the Israelites could walk through on dry land, the God who guided them for 40 years in the wilderness, and so forth. But Moses grew up as a prince in Egypt, and Moses was very, very strongly taught the religious traditions of Egypt. And there's no evidence that you find in the Old Testament to suggest that Moses somehow completely abandoned the idea that those Egyptian gods were gods. But he did not follow them, he did not worship them, he did not honor them. For him, Yahweh, who revealed himself to Moses, even to allow Moses to see his back, for Moses, Yahweh was the only God. But you will see references from Moses and from many of the other people that you see in the Old Testament, prophets as well as historical writings and so on, that refer to the gods of all the other people. They do not say in the Old Testament that there are no other gods but Yahweh, period. There are no other gods but Yahweh for the Israelites. And this is a very, I think, important distinction. And this is the world of the Old Testament, and probably actually the world of the New Testament too, because there were the gods and goddesses of the Romans that were very well known to people during the New Testament time. But the idea of other gods and goddesses of other people was just, it was sort of an assumption that this is how it is. But among the Israelites, you will have no other gods before me. That was, you remember, the first commandment? And that word before means before my face. If you look at it in the Hebrew, you will have no other gods before me. In other words, no other gods in front of me. In other words, you will only know me and no other gods. I am your God, your only God. And so, as regards Yahweh, for the Israelite people, they were to be monotheistic. But in terms of how they lived in regard to the world around them, they were henotheistic, because there were the gods of the Syrians and the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Canaanites and the Egyptians and so forth. And there was no real attempt to theologically or philosophically or in some other way dispose of all these other gods, but rather simply to realize that, okay, if there are other gods of other peoples, that doesn't matter. You are the people of Yahweh. And you will have one and only one God that you worship, honor, and follow. And that is Yahweh. And so basically the Old Testament is henotheistic. It's monotheistic for the Israelites, but henotheistic in terms of the worldview that there are other gods among other peoples. And fundamentally, most of the world that we live in, outside of Judaism and Christianity, has to even today be thought of as henotheistic, because there are other people who believe in other gods. Today, we may make philosophical arguments, we may make theological arguments that there is one and only one God. And for us as Christians and Jews, yes, it is true. There is one and only one God, Yahweh. But Islam says, yeah, there's one and only one God, Allah. Muslims want Allah to be Yahweh, but it's not the same. And then you go beyond that, and you look at the other religions around the world, and you get many, many other gods and goddesses that are out there. And so the world we live in may, for us, be monotheistic. But if you go around the world everywhere, even today, the world is henotheistic, meaning that there are many gods and goddesses that you will find among different peoples of the world. Even though we are monotheistic, and we, at least by faith, believe that the God that we worship and honor, and who has redeemed us and who has created us and so on, is the one true only God. I mean, this is something that we know, but not something the rest of the world necessarily knows, agrees with, or accepts.